Last time we were talking in 2 Thessalonians 1 about the work that God has done, for which Paul was obligated, he said, to give thanks. And we only looked at the issue of their enlarged faith as a topic for our study. And we were looking at the fact that a growing faith is evidence of the working of God in the lives of those who are believing, because a growing faith is not automatic to every believer. There are many, many, many places in the Scriptures where people who are in the family of God are not growing in faith. The Thessalonian situation was different in that regard. He didn't have the hang-ups that some of the other churches had in his interactions with the Thessalonians, and he felt like that was evidence of God's working in a rather remarkable way. And I've said this over and over again, but God often does remarkable things occasionally, not to establish them as a norm or a pattern for our expectation, but to establish something about his own character. In 1 Timothy, for example, Paul point blankly says that he received grace from God because of his depravity, that he was the chief of sinners, but God had decided to use him as an overt demonstration of the enormous extent of his mercy. If he would save the chief of sinners, then many others would be able to say, well, if he would have grace for a guy like that, maybe there'd be grace for me too. That's kind of a dangerous thought, because we tend to think, because I'm not as bad as he was. But the fact is, there can only be one chief of sinners, and by inspiration, Paul claimed the category, so I guess none of the rest of us are as bad as he. But nonetheless, that's just God's way of saying, look, these are the possibilities. And he does it for strengthening our confidence in the kind of God, the kind of person he is. So Paul really feels an obligation to God to give thanks for this side of the coin, this faith being greatly enlarged. There is another side of the coin, and that's what happens when God is working to increase the faith of his people. I really believe that the next comment, or the next issue in the verse, verse 3, that the love of each one of you toward one another grows ever greater, is the other side of that coin. When people are growing in their confidence in God, they're becoming more and more free, in the sense that they don't have to protect themselves because they believe that God's their God and Father, and so they're free to let their circumstances come and go as they come and go under the oversight of a Father who cares about them. So the greater our confidence in God grows, the freer we become. The freer we become, the more loving we can be. It's not automatic. I mean, we won't necessarily be more loving, but at least we can be. Because the whole issue of loving one another, you know, the love growing ever greater, has issues with how tightly we're bound up in ourselves, because that's the contrast to love. So I really believe that the issue is that Paul is dealing with how God designed us. We are designed to be God's instruments for the true good of the lives of other people, particularly other believers. We're in the world for, in large measure, to be instruments of God for the benefit of others. And that's why at the end of the book of Galatians, after he goes through the whole process of trying to get them back on target and unveils this whole issue of life by the Spirit, he says at the end of it all that we should seek to do good to all men, especially those of the household of faith. So that being an instrument in God's hands is part of this whole objective. God has got this intermediate objective in mind. Always in view of what we've studied in 1 Thessalonians 5. He's got a plan for us in his kingdom. And the more we learn about walking in the light here, the more qualified we are there. So that's the whole idea. So in the Scriptures, those that are greatest examples of faith were also exemplary examples of personal sacrifice for the sake of those that they love, particularly God and God's people. Outside of Jesus, there are two people in the scriptures that declared the magnitude of their love to include the honest willingness to go to hell forever for somebody else's sake. Moses asked God to delete him from the book of life for the sake of the people of Israel. And God turned him down flat. I'm not going to delete you, I'm going to delete them. But the offer was real. Moses meant it. And Paul says, qualifying it in three different ways before he says it, that he's telling the truth, he's not lying, that the Holy Spirit's bearing witness with his spirit, that he would be willing to be a curse from Christ for the sake of his brethren according to the flesh, who are his persecutors. So Paul and Moses both were brought to a very high degree of willingness to sacrifice for others, but both of them had remarkable confidence in God too. So I think there's that tie. So this evening what we're going to do is look at this second thing that God is doing in the midst of the Thessalonian church, and that is he's causing this love of each one of them to grow greater and greater. Now, I say that way on the heels of a couple of verses in 1 Thessalonians, so I'm going to turn your attention back, like we didn't spend enough time in 1 Thessalonians. But anyway, chapter 3 of 1 Thessalonians, in verse 12, Paul just says, in a kind of a benedictory kind of comment, because verses 11 through 13 are a kind of a conclusion, in a sense, of a section of the book. In verse 12, he says, "May the Lord cause you to increase and abound in love for one another and for all men, just as we also do for you." So that the idea of the Lord causing you to increase and abound is part of Paul's desire. This "may the Lord do this" as an expression of his wish. And then if you go on over to chapter 4, verse 9, he says, "Now, as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another." So in 1 Thessalonians, there were these two paragraphs that had to do with his desire to see God cause their love for one another to grow. He expresses a wish in chapter 3, and then he actually says, you don't really need anybody to teach you to love one another because God's doing that. He's teaching you to that. A couple of observations in light of those things. When Paul said in chapter 3, verse 12 of the first letter that he wanted the Lord to make them increase and abound in love toward one another, that was kind of a precursor to the next verse, chapter 3, verse 13, where he is going to establish their hearts in unblameable holiness before God. And it's made in the context of chapter 3, it's made on the heels of Timothy's report as he has come back from Thessalonica and gotten down to Corinth, where Paul currently is. When you read chapter 3, you know that Paul was in this sweat about whether the Thessalonians were going to hang in there because they were being persecuted for their faith, and what God was doing in their midst was being fought tooth and nail by their adversary. And Paul always was concerned with new converts as to whether they were flash-in-the-pan believers, you know, those that believe for a little while and then when persecution comes, or whether they were going to hang in there. And he had extensive experience probably with all kinds of variations in between all those different aspects of people's faith and their believing. But nonetheless, when Timothy came to Corinth and told Paul that the Thessalonians were just as gung-ho now as they were when Paul was run out of town, in a lot of ways, that settled Paul's whole thinking down for the Thessalonians. Because at the end of chapter 3, you have this, "Now may God our Father himself and Jesus our Lord direct our way to you, and may the Lord cause you to increase and abound in love for one." And it's kind of, he's kind of winding up a whole segment of his letter just before he goes into the issue on the sexual purity and the rapture in chapter 4. So the point is that in the larger context, the Galatian debacle that Paul had already experienced on the first missionary journey and afterwards, and the letter that we studied to those people, were obviously not like the Thessalonians. And it probably made Paul's longing to see God work in such a way that he would validate the claims of the gospel in a more potent demonstration. And there's some danger in that. This is an aside, but just let me say this about what our expectations are. I have a friend who has a Pollyanna view of what the presence of the Spirit in your life means. He thinks that if you're a true believer, you're not going to do this or 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 anything else he wouldn't do. But I see the message of the gospel and the presence of the Spirit as offering great potential and possibility, but I don't see any guarantees in that regard, because I see believers all through the New Testament and in the letters that Paul writes doing all kinds of stupid stuff, and the Holy Spirit doesn't keep them from doing it. And Paul even has to write to, like the Galatians, and nail their hides to the wall because they're not listening to the Holy Spirit, if indeed he hasn't gone completely silent. So I really think that we need to be aware that we can't just automatically assume that the presence of the Spirit of God in our lives is going to guarantee certain results, because the New Testament won't support that. The guarantees are, they're like in 1 Thessalonians 5:23 and 4, God has this place for you and he's going to get you ready for it, but you don't know what that place is. And Paul did tell Timothy that in a great house there are many vessels, some to honor, some to dishonor. And you purge yourself from the dishonorable stuff and you'll be a vessel of honor. So he threw that back on the human response to God in terms of faith and love. So there is this guarantee that the plan of God is finally going to be proven to be accurate. But in the details of life, you really don't want to be a vessel dishonored in a great house. You want to grow in your faith in the Lord, and you want to depend on him to cause that to happen, and you want to become more of a loving person, and you want to depend on him to make that happen, because you can't make yourself do either one of those things. So my point is this: the Thessalonian experience was not the norm. This is a unique church. God was obviously far more engaged to accomplish something that would set those Thessalonians up as people to be imitated, because that's what happened. All over Macedonia, the Thessalonians were the ones that were being imitated, because their reputation was going everywhere. And in fact, Paul was part of the spread of that reputation, as we'll see in our study in 2 Thessalonians, if we ever get to the next verse. Because he says, therefore we ourselves speak proudly of you among the churches. So we're part of the reason why your reputation is spreading like it is, because we're bragging about you. But nonetheless, that's what that issue in 1 Thessalonians 3 at the end of the chapter is about. Paul has been given the evidence that he longed to get when Timothy showed up, and now he's settled. These guys are God's work for a special result, and he's doing it, and it just thrills my soul. He says, I live when you're faithful like this, and I want God to do even more, because he wants the Lord to increase their love for one another and yet even more. And then in chapter 4, he says, in regard to the love for one another, you don't really need anybody to write to you, because you are doing this. You're taught by God to love one another. But he said in verse 10, indeed you do practice it, but we urge you, brethren, to excel still more. So here's the obsessive compulsive personality never being satisfied. So, you know, but that is kind of the way we are, you know, never satisfied with the status quo. Keep pressing on. Well, in a sense, that's exactly right, because we do need to be constantly pressing on. But that statement also, there are some believers who grow in faith and others veer off into increasing disaster. That's obvious from Paul's instruction, for example, to the Corinthians with the guy who's living with his father's wife. Turn him over to Satan in order for him to be, his spirit to be saved in the day of the Lord Jesus. Nail his hide to the walls, what he's saying. obviously the guy's not growing in faith and biblical love. So that happens. The Lord does not always cause people to increase and abound in love one toward another. And that's obvious. That's obvious. Everybody has had an experience in a church somewhere where people were more hateful than they were loving. And they were professing believers, and things got sorry bad because they didn't love one another. So this deal about Paul wanting God to increase their love for one another is real. And that's part of the reason why I felt so obligated to give thanks to God, because he was doing this in the Thessalonians case. The issue in 1 Thessalonians 4:9, where he says, God's teaching you to do this, is immediately after his instruction on controlling your own body so that you don't get sucked into these physical appetite things and get deflected by those. And it's right before the teaching on the rapture, which is the blessed hope. So the statement is made in the sense that God is teaching us to love one another. And I really believe he'll teach us to do that if we're open to be taught that. And that is a real issue, whether we're open to being taught to love one another. But anyway, if you read, for example, the emphatic words in 1 John in relation to loving one another, you don't get the impression that John is writing to people who were really making a clear demonstration of loving one another because they were taught by God. Because John says in 1 John, you guys need to know this. If you claim to love God and don't love your neighbor, you're lying. You don't have to say that to people who are loving one another. You have to say that to people who are deceiving themselves. So it strongly implies that the foundations for Paul's gratitude is that God is doing something in Thessalonica in relation to faith and love that is a little bit abnormal. But I think that instead of writing it off as, well, okay, if it's abnormal, then I can't really expect that for myself. No, that's the wrong conclusion to draw. Yes, it's abnormal. But it is an illustration of what's possible if you're willing to allow God to strengthen your confidence in him so that he can build your love for other people. He can do that. But he really won't just run over you to do it. It's kind of like, I can do this for you if you'll let me. And that's kind of the whole idea. And so what Paul is doing here in 2 Thessalonians, is he's talking about a theme that he's already addressed in the first letter. But what he's actually saying in verse 3 of chapter 1 of 2 Thessalonians is that the love of each one of you toward one another grows ever greater. What he's saying is they're making remarkable progress in learning how to work through the complexities of what it means to love. There was a song years ago. I don't know who crooned it. But it was, love is a many-splintered thing. Well, some wag turned that into, love is a many-splintered thing. So don't slide down the banister of love. Love is a very complicated, sometimes very messy thing. So what Paul is saying is that the Thessalonians are showing a demonstrated ability to handle the complexities. And their ability is increasing regularly. They're growing in their ability to handle the complexities. So let's think about the complexities of love. I think one of the perhaps more significant complexities of the kind of love that God and Paul are talking about in this text is that love is both a fixed and rigid system of priorities, where you have a fixed, rigid, this is more important than this, but this is more important than this, but this is more important than this, this is more important than this, this is more important than this, and then finally you get down to zero, this is more important than this, and everything under this is not important at all. That's the bottom line. When stuff ceases to be important in any setting, it's below the line. So love, in a real sense, is fixed and rigid. You can't adjust things because there is this reality of the rigid, fixed thing, but the complexity comes in that not only is that true, but also love is a fluid and situational system of priorities. Because the rigid system is relatively large, but the fluid and situational thing, it gets into play when in your system you say, this is more important than this, but in this situation, this now is more important than that. Because the situation calls for it. So there are, on the one hand, certain priorities that God has established that are fixed as priorities. They're not to be compromised. They're fundamental to what it means to love. And a person is going to grow in love in direct relation to how he relates to the fixed and rigid, unyielding, uncompromising issues. I heard today, I don't know if you've heard it yet or not, but the Pope has gotten a word from God and he's going to rewrite the Ten Commandments. In fact, he's already rewritten them. Now there are 11. And they include gays and lesbians and those kind of people. And I wouldn't be surprised, though I haven't read it yet because I haven't been online, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's not a sin to do anything that would cause the temperature of the earth to go up. But anyway, you start messing with the Ten Commandments and you're messing with a fairly rigid system of the love of God. Because Jesus said the first four of the Big Ten focused on loving the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and that was the greatest commandment. And the last six were summarized under loving your neighbor as yourself, and that was next to the greatest. So those are the two biggies. And they're developed in 10 parts. So the whole idea of a fixed and rigid system makes abounding in love a significant difficulty. Because even as regenerated children of God, we still have a potent natural inclination to look out for ourselves. It's knee-jerk and unthinking in its reaction. I didn't intend to spoil my thunder by talking about shooting my finger with a nail gun this week. But when I put my hand up there against those three boards and put the nail gun up on this side and pull the trigger, I did not stand there thinking, I wonder if this pain I'm feeling is the will of God and if I'm supposed to endure it or not. It's just a knee-jerk reaction. Yeah! Swinging blood everywhere. Well, I think that that's kind of an illustration of the way we are. We react to the things that hurt us physically, emotionally, or spiritually in a knee-jerk fashion. It's going to be automatic how we do this, especially if we were caught by surprise. Now, I believe Jesus could lay down on a wooden cross, stretch his arms out however he did. I mean, I'm not sure they know how the cross was formed, but nonetheless, those soldiers took those spikes and Jesus knew what they're going to do. And he had plenty of time to think about what was going to happen. And so when they put those nails against his flesh and raised the hammer, he knew that was going to be extremely painful. And he didn't move. Because this was the will of God. That didn't catch him off guard. He knew it was coming. He's not really a good illustration for us because he's perfect and we're not. But the point is, we have this built-in natural inclination to react to pain physically, emotionally, or spiritually in a self-preserving way, and therefore it makes observing a rigid system of priorities where this is important, this is important, this is important, this is important, and don't get them out of order because they're important in this order. It makes it very difficult to adhere to that when something comes in from left field and whacks you and all of a sudden this is more important than even that. I heard a fellow believer one time when he was working on a piece of equipment that had been running and was hot, and he touched the exhaust pipe and immediately a curse came out of his mouth. And, you know, I was a little disappointed in that, but I'm not sure I wouldn't have done it myself. I mean, the point is, that curse was way down here in terms of the person's typical value system. But in the presence of pain, it jumped way up here. So, to have a system of love that is increasing and you're growing in your ability to operate by it, that's going to run completely contrary to your natural self a lot of the time. And to have a love toward God that allows Him to dictate all the circumstances and responses that we give to those circumstances without argument. To have that kind of a love is a significant possession. I had some friends in Nebraska. I had them as friends because they're in glory now. I guess they're still my friends, but I don't get to talk to them anymore. But they lost a son in a tragic accident when he was just a young man. And his daddy told me one time while we were having coffee at the coffee shop that he and his wife had just decided they were not going to permit this to make them bitter. And it showed in the way their lives progressed beyond that. It showed because they said, we've got this system, and in it, God is at the top. And if He decides to take our son, He decides to take our son. We're not going to let that turn us against Him, become embittered. It was a decision they made. So that's a significant possession, to have a love for God that lets Him dictate the circumstances, either by direct imposition or by permission of others. He lets others do evil and you get splattered by it. In all of that, our responses, His permissions and insertions, no argument on our part. That's a love for God that's a significant possession. And to have a love for other people, and particularly saints, that allows their true needs to supersede our own plans and aspirations is also a significant possession. To love one another more than our commitment to our own agenda and our own aspiration, that's a significant possession, to love like that. So when I say that increasing and abounding in love toward one another is a remarkable thing, it is. Because there are plenty of things working against that developing, but that's just one of the complications. You have this rigidly declared system. I'm looking at my notes to see whether I included that. I didn't. In my study notes, I included the fact that Jesus said, if you love father, mother, brother, sister, children, lands, whatever, more than me, you're not worthy of me. Well, that would sound like an egotist in most settings. But he wasn't saying it egotistically. He was just saying, look, love is a very rigid thing, and you have to decide who is on the top of the priority list in your life. You have to make those decisions, and you have to do it as a rigid commitment so that it's unyielding and uncompromised. But on the other hand, love is complex because it's never found in simple one-on-one situations. So that the only thing you ever have to do is just sacrifice to this other individual's need, and you've loved. Love is never that way. I can't think of a situation where it's possible to love one other person without any consideration for anybody else, because we were born into a multi-personal universe and the things we do splatter on other people. There may be an issue one-on-one that we have to deal with in terms of love, but whatever we decide here is going to splatter outwardly too. There are other people involved. And so love gets real complicated at that point because love is supposed to be for everybody, including your enemies. And if it were just one-on-one, it would just be a matter of you saying, okay, my wants, my aspirations, even my needs are not as important as this person, even though he's my enemy or whatever, he's more important than I am. On a one-on-one, if it were possible for it to be just one-on-one, that's the way it would be. But there are more people in this world than Carter's got liver pills, or maybe we should upgrade that to Carter has peanuts. But nonetheless, when you start talking about a rigid, fixed system of God and others, you're all of a sudden faced with some situations where, okay, who do I love the most in this situation? Because what will happen is, this person's need will either be met or denied when you address this person's need. And so if this person's need cancels this person's need, you then have to decide, okay, whose need am I supposed to meet? And whoever you choose, the other one's going to be hated in that situation. That's why Paul said in Romans 9, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. It's a choice where you can't meet them both. And that's the complexity. And that's the situational fluid reality of love. Because in a rigid system, all you got to do is love God and love your neighbors. Well, the problem is there are too many neighbors. And so, given the situation, you're liable to love this person in this situation, and this person's going to get denied. But in another situation, that person's going to get what he needs, and this one will be denied. It gets really complicated, and that's why you have to be flexible and situational. Because one kind of situation will require a certain kind of sacrifice, and another situation will require exactly the opposite concerning who gets to be the beloved in the situation. Who gets demoted on the priority scale. The easiest illustration is the one I've often used. If it's one-on-one, me or somebody else, and it's their life or mine, love would say, your life's more important to me than my life is. I'll die here. But if the issue is, okay, you're not asking for my life, you're asking for my wife's life. All of a sudden, I've got to decide, okay, who am I supposed to love the most here? And quite frankly, my wife wins hands down. The enemy can go to hell as far as that's concerned in that situational setting. So, you know, guy busts in your house with a gun and your family's there. Guess who's going to die? They ain't going to be the family members if you've got anything to do with it, because you're called to love and protect and that kind of thing. Well, that's a situation where you have to decide, okay, who am I going to love and to what degree? And it's not easy. Because somebody's going to get demoted in that setting. And that conundrum is made even more complex by the fact that we cannot even successfully maintain the rigidity of God first unless we know what God's love requires. And that doesn't even ask about those less than God who are in the situation whose lives are going to be affected by whatever we decide. So love is a complicated thing. And so for Paul to say, you guys are showing a remarkable ability to ferret through this complexity and demonstrate love for one another on an ever-growing, increasing basis. And then thirdly, if that's not complicated enough for you, love is never a matter of the wants and needs of the beloved. It's always a matter of the true, eternal need of the beloved. And that's where we get all balled up, because we think if somebody makes a demand on us that we're supposed to meet it out of love. Well, that demand may be simply a demand for more self-gratification on their part. There is nothing that requires love to meet that demand. In fact, it's a disaster to enable people to be more and more wicked. In fact, I used the illustration last week. I made a mental note of it and even deleted something what I said about it. But when I'm driving the speed limit and I pull off on the shoulder to let somebody break the law and go on by, that's not love. It's just wanting them off my bumper. Unless it's love for my wife who's in the car that might get wrecked if they hit me or something like that. But it's never that. It's just, all right, get going by. Who cares if you're sinning? Well, I'm supposed to care. But on the other hand, I'm not the police and it's not my job to enforce the law. But nonetheless, the issue of permission, letting people do meanness or onerous in the name of love is just not. That's not wise. That's not valid. Love these days has degenerated into likes and dislikes and often denies the real reality or the real need altogether. the qualifiers true and eternal need are heavy operators in the formula, and they're not without complication themselves. But the fact is, Paul saw in the Thessalonian situation a remarkable demonstration of people who may not have even thought through the complexities, but were living an outworking of them. Which proves what? That God is causing you to increase in this. God is the one who teaches us how to respond. And it's not like, well, I've got to spend the next 30 days figuring out how I'm going to respond to this particular situation. God hasn't called us to live that way. He's called us to live as it comes. Take it as it comes. Walking by the Spirit doesn't mean being able to sit down and plan everything out. Walking by the Spirit means depending on God to give you the response that you need at the time and go with it. And living life that way is a healthy way to live. Now, on occasion, you will look back and think, well, that wasn't the Spirit that led me to do that, because look at some of these things that were involved in that. But more times than not, if you're trying to walk by the Spirit, you'll look back and say, man, I didn't have the wisdom to make that kind of decision, but I made it. Who's responsible for that? God is. And that's what Paul was seeing in the Thessalonians' lives. They hadn't been believers long enough to work through all the complexities. They were simply living in a growing faith that allowed them to be more and more free. And that's how I think that Paul understands this development in verse 3. God is increasing their faith, and their love for one another is growing ever greater. And I don't think it's an accident that faith is mentioned first. Love is never existent in a context of unbelief or disbelief. And it's only by an increasing faith in God that believers become more and more free to put their own agendas in the trash so that God and others can occupy the greater position. And that's our calling. We're called to grow in our ability to say to God and to one another, whatever you want, whatever you need, that's what I'm committed to. And if I have to junk some stuff in order to get it done, then we'll junk the stuff to get it done. That's growing in love. But it doesn't happen until we're growing in faith first. Because we really have to have confidence in God in order to be free enough to love.